Welcome to the Phoenix Cast, a podcast about cybersecurity, technology, and innovation issues in the military. We are your hosts, John.
And Kyle.
I'm a U.S. Marine, and the opinions expressed on the cast are my own, not official military policy.
And the opinions expressed by me are also my own, not those of my employer or any other businesses I happen to be associated with.
For today's episode, no special guests, just the love between the hosts.
Oh, yeah.
And Kyle, we have promised the listeners this one for quite a long time, and this is personally near and dear to my heart. And we've talked a bunch about all the different cloud technologies. We've talked about software factories. We've talked about DevOps and SecDevOps, but we've never kind of had a John and Kyle just sit down and do an explainer.
Ooh, yes. And in particular, we've talked about DevOps. We've had Gene Kim on the cast. We've done DevOps to death, but we've kind of went back to this. We listened to some of the feedback on Twitter, and we've never actually explained what this is to everybody. Now, this may be a bit elementary to some of the listeners that are out there, but it also, we feel, will be very enlightening to people who aren't necessarily eating, sleeping, and breathing DevOps all day, every day.
Yeah, if you are sitting in a room and you want to be a little bit smarter on all of this stuff and making sure that you're keeping up with the conversation and tuned into what does this actually mean for the military, this is the cast for you. If you write code 24 hours a day, this is not the John and Kyle teach you a bunch of stuff you never knew.
And right at the beginning, I want to do one quick thing and get out of the way some arguments around terminology. We are going to use DevOps to talk about the entirety of taking, I have an idea of I want to build software, and then having that software be deployed somewhere and usable by somebody. Now, that somebody could be a piece of artificial intelligence or an API or a human. It kind of doesn't matter. But there is a lot of debate out there between DevOps versus SRE versus platform engineering. And we're just gonna wave at that and walk right on by today, okay? Now, there's too much involved in that. John, your thoughts?
Yeah, and I just want to put, in addition to what Kyle said, yes, we're going to wave and we're not going to anchor too much on that stuff. Additionally, we're going to use some products and we're going to use it simply to aid in your understanding. If Kyle uses a term or a vendor that isn't using that word or that vendor because that's the best one that the cast necessarily endorses or does not endorse, we're simply putting this out there to aid in your understanding.
Agree. And just remember, there are a million tools out there that can help you accomplish a thing. The tool is not what's important. Having a system or a process in place is what is important.
Yes.
John, any other hedging we need to do on this other than saying, you know, we don't sponsor any of these tools. None of these tools sponsor us. We're a complete nonprofit cast. Our opinions are our own. And I know, since I'm going to be leading a little bit of this discussion, I'm going to give a lot of my own opinions in here, all right? I am very biased as a human when it comes to some of these technology choices. I have had numerous professional paid job titles that include the word DevOps and or director or leader or manager in some way, shape, or form. So I've done a lot of this at scale in my previous jobs. And through my current and recent jobs, I've helped a lot of companies and customers figure all this stuff out at scale as well.
Let's get into it.
All right. So this whole thing starts with a giant infinity symbol representing that this cycle is never over in DevOps. You're never done with anything. It is continuous, which is another term that we're going to get into a little bit later here. But it starts with planning. How are you going to do what you're going to do? Then you code. You actually make your fingers dance across the keyboards and you write beautiful script. Then you build this into some form of artifact. You're then able to test that artifact against a bunch of rules. Once you know that it passes those rules, you then release it into some kind of artifact repository or holding area in some way, shape, or form. That we're hyper simplifying that. Then you deploy it into an actual environment or test environment, whatever you want. Then you operate and monitor that thing, i.e., is it working the way that I wanted? And then, oh, by the way, probably not. So what am I going to do? I'm going to plan, code, build, test, release, deploy, operate, monitor, plan,
and
code,
into
build,
infinity
test,
we go.
And into infinity we go. Now, the words dev and ops in this little infinity symbol can generally be described by the left hemisphere of this infinity symbol and the right hemisphere of this infinity symbol, meaning planning, coding, building, and testing are generally considered developer responsibilities, and releasing, deploying, operating, and monitoring are generally described as operational requirements or operational responsibilities, i.e. the dev and the ops. Again, we are very purposely ignoring SecDevOps, which there is a security rider at each stage of this journey, but maybe we'll get into that in a future cast. All right, so those are the stages. We're going to dive a little deeper into each one of these and give some examples of how this all kind of works. So when it comes to planning, step one, right? You need to have a proper plan. You need to have some form of project idea of what you're going to accomplish. And you need to have some kind of tech stack identified of how you're going to get it done. If you just wing this, it's going to end very poorly for you. Generally speaking, from a tools perspective, planning is just your project management software or whatever you're using to run your Agile methodology or ShapeUp. There's a bunch of different tools. There's a bunch of different systems out there. We're not passing judgment upon any, but just have it written down and have some way to track how you are doing on it. That leads us to step two, code.
Now, hey, before we start coding, though, let's give the listeners some feedback here. Have you ever actually seen anybody wing it on planning?
This feels like a trick question because, of course, I've seen a bunch of people wing it on planning.
And there's such a thing as an MVP, and there are those that are just kind of like, how do I know? How do what's your tip off where you're like, they did not hit the M of MVP as a minimum viable product?
There we go. Minimum viable product. I like the term MVP. I think people take it too far. Meaning when you say an MVP is like it's deployed to production, I'm like, that doesn't feel very M in the minimum viable product. That feels like a big viable product, and that kind of stinks. Where I see most people make a mistake is in not scaling down your minimum. So I'm going to double click on what you said there. When we went to the software factory, they were actually big on this too. They were like, what is the absolute minimum that we can build to put it in the hands of a user and get feedback on it as soon as humanly possible? Again, the most important thing in product management is to spend the minimum effort to get the maximum feedback so that you can continue to get better at what you do and build a product that's actually meeting the needs of the end user. So what I would say is, if the simplest solution is you writing, like creating buttons by drawing them on sticky notes and putting them on a whiteboard, and having the customer, i.e. the test user or whatever, walk through it and tell you where the UI is broken, that feels like the right amount of juice versus squeeze. You don't have to get like a fancy Figma front-end framework that you build out that has all these cool, sexy graphics. You don't need that. That's a waste of time if you haven't gotten the initial feedback yet. So crawl, walk, run, and maybe even like roll over, lift head, scoot, crawl, walk, run to some extent.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so we're jumping into now code. And this is one of those things that people get really wrapped around the axle on in so many ways. So code is where your developers start, again, typing up examples and typing up situations where they have actual scripts that are running, compiling, or doing whatever their specific version of code does, and proving that the thing can function, right? John's going to have a ton of questions here. John.
Yes. So there is something that I feel definitely needs to be discussed, and it starts with a capital G. Ooh. So there are the three G's in my mind. There is Git, GitHub, and GitLab. And sometimes folks use these interchangeably, and normally that is where I'm like, uh-oh, we could be in some troubles here. You please, for the audience, give a quick explainer of the three, and how do these things even relate to code? Are they really even required?
Totally. Okay. So let's start at the beginning. Git is a proper noun because it is a piece of software, but it is not Coke and Pepsi, meaning it does not apply to all the things in its world. Okay. Git is a version control system. All right. And what this means is when something changes, it provides a method for you to know that that changed and to track the changes. So technically, you can use Git on anything that you want to just monitor if it has changed. However, Git is very specifically built for source code control, meaning it's designed for you to interact with code that you have written and use that to monitor and adjust those changes.
Yes. And terminology wise, I've read a bunch of documentation on this. Two terms that you may or may not have heard before, code repository and source control are normally terms you'll hear associated with this.
That's right. Yeah. Basically, there is a place that I store my stuff and I know when it changes and who changed it is generally how that all works. And that often comes with a versioning system too. Like this is code version 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, but it does that on a per file and in some cases, a per line capability.
And as it just so happens, when you're writing code, especially depending on the language and whatever, spaces and nuance and itty bitty little things matter. And this makes that simple both for you writing code and then you pulling it down in many different places and getting a consistent feeling from all of that.
Mm-hmm. And again, for all the listeners out there who are extremely technical, we are glossing over some key details here. So just remember that this is supposed to be a primer for DevOps. Git equals the way that you monitor your code for changes and track those changes. Now, that leads us into GitHub and GitLab, which are very similar things. So what GitHub and GitLab are platforms that allow you to do a bunch more using Git behind the scenes as the method for interacting with that code, but allowing a bunch more capability on top of that. They also happen to store the code that you are interacting with in the cloud, right? In the very traditional sense of the word, in someone else's servers that you can then access and control access to those things, provide some basic RBAC or permissioning systems that go into place. But they allow you to do three really critical things, which is called forking, pulling, and merging. All right. Forking is the process of copying any code from one repository into a temporary or permanent location where you can then modify it. So a very basic example of this is I go to google.com and somehow I have access to their source code, which again, just play along. But I say the background is white and I really don't like that. I want the background to be green. And so I would fork that website, change the background color from white to green and say, haha, now this is mine now. I made this. Obviously, don't do that. Copyright will get you every time. But that would be a way you would fork something. You just want to take a bunch of code that someone else has written or contributed to. And often this happens in open source communities. MySQL is a very famous database that was forked into the Maria database. And there's bunches of examples of this all over the world where someone's like, there's one thing that doesn't exist in this open source repository and I want to make it mine, so I fork it. You can also perform a pull, which means when you are finished making some changes in that fork, you can share it with the original owner using a thing called a pull request, which generally says, hi, I have made changes to your code, and I would like you to take a look at this and decide if you want to merge that code. And that's that third factor of this. This is where owners of code repositories can look at it and go, I like those changes, I accept them and want to roll them out into the master repository in some way, shape, or form. Again, we don't choose the terminology here, but that is what it's called still. And you can click a button and basically say, I approve this, and it will smash that change down into the original repository and say, this is now the new original, and it will increment the version of that code. So you want to change someone's code. You don't just go in there and edit the line. You fork it, and then you make your changes, and then you submit a pull request that gets reviewed, and then it is merged into the master, and now it is official in some way, shape, or form. And that is generally what GitHub has brought to massive popularity. GitHub is the most popular source repository service, if you will, that exists in the world. But GitLab is another one of those. Now, it takes things in a slightly different way. So it simply allows you to do things in a more nuanced user permission way, and it has included into it a continuous integration and continuous deployment framework. So GitHub is more of a, or GitLab, even I messed this stuff up, GitHub is more of a backend where you're saying, this is where all my code lives and how I edit my code and how I distribute my code in some way, shape, or form. GitLab takes that and says, yes, and we're going to have some orchestration on top of it that allows you to do more CI and CD, which we're going to get to here in just a couple seconds.
So quick recap. You can, on your Raspberry Pi at home, you can run Git and you can have your code in version control locally if you want to. You don't technically need anything else. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to, you could upload your code to GitHub. And like we've talked about in previous casts, GitHub has a couple extra, in addition to all the storage and the ability for you to freely share with others without letting people into your personal network. It also has some of those cool things like the features that tell you, oh, hey, I saw a password here. I saw what sure looks to be like a private key that you probably shouldn't have embedded in your repo, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then GitLab has all that those extra features that Kyle talked about that brings all the goodness.
That's right. And so GitLab in particular is going to take the next like six steps and combine them all into one under their product. There are pros and cons to that, but either way. All right, John, have we beaten code to the ground?
I think we got code. We wrote some stuff and we put it somewhere.
All right. 1/4 of the way done. We're 2 out of 8. Let's move on to number 3. Number 3 in this cycle is build. Now, build means where all the thingies that the developers have created, all the code files and all the things, they get packaged and quote unquote built, or built, that's the best way to put it, into some kind of artifact or package. And they're usually designed with the end computing procedure in place, meaning, is this going to be a VM when it's all said and done? Is this going to be a container when it's all said and done? Is this going to be a serverless function that is deployed somewhere when it's all said and done? That generally is how you go from I have code to I have a thing that can be run by a user or an administrator somewhere. Now, this is also commonly known as compiling, though that is something that happens exceedingly rarely in the modern world. That's like an old assembly in like C language idiom, if you will. Now, building is complex, and there are many ways to do this, but I want to give a couple examples here. Building into a VM or building into a software installer, like what used to happen when they would build like Windows 95 and all these different things, takes a lot of time, right? Compiling software into an executable takes an exceedingly long amount of time and usually requires very large build farms that used to be used in a lot of different software manufacturers in the world. Now, that can take hours, days, weeks, even in some ways and shapes and forms. But building into a VM is usually accomplished by a few different types of tools, which we'll get into here in a little bit. But it also takes a lot of time to build a VM because you have all this underlying operating system installation that you have to do and configuration that takes time. And you're basically operating at the speed of the computer operating the operating system. I realize I use the word operating 8 times in that sentence, but still, bear with me. Containers are awesome in that they build way, way faster, and they allow much easier configuration change later on. And in when we get to step 6 here for deploy, they also deploy way faster. So there's a few different bits and bobs that go into that. But just remember that if you are building a VM, for example, using like Chef or Puppet or Packer in some way, shape, or form, these are common software tools that allow you to do this, and it takes you 45 minutes to build your new image, it's going to be really tough to have continuous deployment later because any change requires a 45-minute round-trip time for you to know if something's good or bad, and that is assuming nothing goes wrong.
So, Kyle, quick question here. Was speed the only thing that containers solved, or was there another problem here that containers helped with?
You're just asking me to have this podcast go 4 hours now, aren't you? Okay. No, containers solved a bunch of other problems that we like to do, meaning, you know, obfuscating the way that you run and allowing you to have add-ons, and just there's a million things that I could go into here. I'm going to try and not
consistency for dependencies. Like you could get into dependency hell if you were just like, hey, I'm just going to deploy some code to any random Linux VM.
That's right.
Yeah, that could be terrible.
It could be super duper terrible. And at the end of the day, when we're concerned with things like software supply chain compromises, as well as hardware compromises, the ability to build a container is a very sane modern way to take software that you want to run and package it in a way that is both efficient in terms of storage, efficient in terms of time needed to build, efficient in terms of change management capability and the time required to do that, and efficient in the time it takes to actually get it running into production and usable by customers. Containers can launch in literal microseconds, as opposed to taking minutes just for an operating system to boot up, let alone the software to be ready to use.
Thank you.
I love it. Okay. We're going to get to step 4 now, testing. So testing is exactly what it sounds like. It is your opportunity to run tests on the code that you just built to see how it functions. Now, the process of building tests is an absolute art. It is a lot less science, although there are frameworks that you can go into doing this. And you'll hear about us talking about this all the time in the cybersecurity realm too. You have these like MITRE ATT&CK frameworks and things like that. Those are all testing frameworks. And in SecDevOps, as you might imagine, testing is a big factor in the SecDevOps cycle. But generally, I just want you to think that we say a specific amount of data should be sent to this and a specific thing should be returned, and we've tested for that and it actually functions. But I'm massively oversimplifying here, but as a developer or as an operator in some way, shape, or form, you should be confident that the changes that you made to the code or the code that you have created actually does the thing that you wanted it to do. And this is the place where you validate that. You do it before it ever actually makes it onto a server and is running somewhere. You do it in a safe, sandboxy type environment.
Yep. And there are all kinds of different, very specific definitions for the types of tests that you're going to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The question you want to ask yourself is, what is the test I really need to do for whatever it is that my product is, and evaluate. And again, like, there's plenty of documentation on all these different things. You can go all the types of tests, or some of the different types of tests. You probably know for your environment and for your product what you need to test on, and that needs to be built in as part of the cycle.
And John, just because you mentioned it, we'll go into this very quickly, but the most common ones that you're going to find out there are unit testing, integration testing, and smoke testing, and sometimes regression testing as well. Just to give a quick primer on all this, unit testing is when you are testing individual units of code, i.e. like individual files or individual functions, i.e. unit testing. Integration testing involves how the different pieces of code work together, i.e. when I pass a variable or I pass a payload from this function to this function, or this piece of code or this module to this module. It's basically the interconnection of things. So it sometimes you want to test that individual pieces of code operate at a specific speed or are handling variables in a specific way, but the integration testing validates the entirety of the application interaction in some way, shape, or form. You have smoke tests, which involve testing critical functions of the software, i.e. like end to end, did something light on fire and therefore I smell smoke that something's not working correctly. Software developers are great at naming things. We're a very imaginative bunch. And then you have regression testing, which involves the software after changes have been made. So this is much less in the compile phase, but regression testing is super common. Like, I switched this limit on a variable from A to B, or from 1 to 2 or whatever, and how is that impacting performance when I deploy it to like a canary server or a testing server in some way, shape, or form. Those are generally the four most common ones, but again, this is a deep well of experience and knowledge, and people who know this way better than us can come in and talk about this, but that's a quick overview of testing in some way.
Beautiful.
Okay, ready to move on to 5?
Moving on.
All right, then you do the releasing. And the releasing is quite simple. It's where all your integration starts. So we're going to talk about continuous integration here in a second, but it basically repeats this over and over again when there's any update to the application, and it does it all over the place, and it orchestrates this in some way, shape, or form. So this is somewhat difficult to sort of conceptualize, but just think about it like this. Back in the day, it was a Wednesday, and we wanted to deploy code onto a server. We would like SSH to the server or SFTP the files to the server, and then go onto the server and like change where it was loading the files from, and then like restart the service in Linux or whatever. And that was how we would release. Well, that obviously feels terrible in the year 2023. So naturally, we developed a bunch of things that are tools that can help do with this release management. So whenever you hear us talk about like Jenkins, which is, I think, the most common terminology that you will hear people talk about, is a release management tool, which says, okay, great, I know where the artifact is, and I know that your test pass, and I know the destination that all this stuff should go. I'm just going to do all that for you. I'm going to push all that code. I'm going to restart all those services. I'm going to do all that stuff by myself. Now, there are tons of others that we're talking about here in a little bit as well, but generally, it's just the way that you get from my code has passed its tests to all the places it needs to be. Now, we got to go back to the same old concept that we just talked about, VMs versus containers versus serverless functions, et cetera, et cetera. They have different pieces of that puzzle. What's also important here is that a lot of these will handle your artifact creation and storage. Now, the term artifact gets somewhat obfuscated when we start talking about these things. All that means is an end output file of any type that comes at the end of that test cycle where it is ready to be released. So an artifact could be like a zip file or a gzip file. It could be an executable. It could be a binary. It could be all these things that are clumps of code that all go together. It could be a container that gets ready to deploy out to a Docker environment in some way, shape, or form. All these things could be artifacts, but it's just anything that you need, right? Now, artifact storage becomes important because depending on where you want to deploy these things, let's say you're in a global environment, you may not want to download your artifact from North America if you're deploying into Southeast Asia, for example. And so you'd want to bring the artifacts with you. Oftentimes, especially for error management and things like that, people might even store the artifacts in a protected environment on the server or in the container system that you're running so that you don't even have to reach outside. And then you have version control local to the box, i.e. if you lose network connectivity or things like that. So a lot that goes into the release cycle, but that's generally what it means. Take the code and actually put it where it needs to be and have it run. Okay.
I'm with you so far.
All right. Now, this gets a little bit confused with deploy at some way, shape, or form as well. Now, put the things in an environment and have them run is great, but deployment really comes down to deciding where those things actually are. So this is a bit of a chicken and egg. Like, I got to know how to release that software so that I can deploy that software, right? Well, it's like kind of, but you have to kind of know where you want to deploy it before you can release it. So these things merge a lot when people are talking about it, but they are separate categories. So the common things about this is like, do you want to deploy this to production, to test, to dev, or to stage? Or maybe you have 10,000 production environments and 10,000 staging environments. Which specific one do you want to do? All right. Now, there are a lot of orchestration tools that will help you with this. Ansible and Salt are really good ones that kind of focus specifically on this. You can use like Puppet and Chef and even things like Terraform and Pulumi to orchestrate these as well, because they kind of operate in a lot of different areas. However, the deployment is really a specific thing to your environment, so you know where things are going to go.
So for people who maybe aren't familiar with this, why not just deploy to prod every single time? What would be a use case for a company to deploy to stage, for instance?
Yeah, so the real question here is that you want to eliminate the blast radius of code changes. And especially the more often you are updating your code, the more risky that becomes. So if you only release your code once a month, and it's after your developers have been doing stuff for weeks and weeks and weeks and prepping for these things and testing all over the place, you're probably pretty confident that you can have this stuff go out to production. But they've been running that software in versions in smaller environments, like what we would call dev test stage, as they've gone through this process. Now, prod should be a very sacred, protected place for you as any business or any company that is running something in quote unquote production. We don't necessarily want to test on production. That's basically a joke inside the developer community. Like, what are we going to do? Test on prod. It's a bad idea. You shouldn't do that. So we create duplicates of our environments in some way, shape, or form, and we call those other names. Now, staging is generally where you put something where you're like, I'm pretty confident this is going to be good. Usually staging environments are more robust and more mimicky of the environment that you have in prod. The difficulty in duplicating your prod environment, everybody, is that it's expensive. And especially in the olden days before cloud technology, when you had to have like twice as many routers and twice as many switches, it was incredibly expensive. So usually there was only one. But now that we're in a very modern cloud environment, it's actually pennies on the dollar usually to replicate your environments in some way, shape, or form. And so stage usually has a much more accurate copy of the production environment, often has dummy data that is somewhat sanitized or anonymized in some way, shape, or form. And so when you deploy things into stage, you can activate them and test them in a way that is as close as possible to the actual environment. Now, dev and test are exactly what they sound like in some way, shape, or form. So dev is an environment where you've got lots and lots and lots of different variables going on. Usually you might have like a dev environment per developer that you have. It's like a tested sandbox kind of environment where they can do anything they want. Then you've got test, which is generally where teams will put versions of code while they run it through different categories. Whew. All right. So that's dev, test, stage, and prod. John, any other questions on that?
The only thing I would say, Kyle, so to give the users an idea of how you could actually use this. So if you run this awesome site called Kyle.com, and before you send something to production to where the world can see it, you wanted, I think earlier you mentioned about forking some code and changing a color. If you were like, you know, it seemed like a good idea. I know the color's right, but I want to actually run this on my site and see if it looks good. And maybe run, like when Brian came on the cast and talked about how important UI is, maybe somebody other than you, the person writing the code, needs to look at it for some kind of user experience type of stuff, but you don't want to do that while it's running for everyone on the internet. Mm-hmm. That would be an example of where you want to deploy the full set of code, but not to the internet and prod. That'd be a great example, right?
Yeah, you'd put that on stage and then you'd let your QC or your testing team or whoever, even maybe your security team, to look at it so they can run all their penetration tests and things like that on it, where it's in a pseudo production environment, but not actually production. Oftentimes your staging environment is restricted so that only your own employees can access it, or it's on some form of intranet instead of the internet.
Yeah. Like www.kyle.com is prod, and maybe dev.kyle.com is development, and stage.kyle.com is stage, and maybe you limit dev and stage to intranet only or something like that.
Yep. I also just found out the Kyle.com seems to be just a placeholder domain, which seems like an absolute waste. So I will go try and see if I can buy that later on tonight.
This is what I'm here for. All these great ideas.
Exactly. Just finding all these crazy parts. All right. So now we have deployed. And now the real challenge begins. You operate. Now, operate is, it sounds kind of like what it is, but operate really also involves the infrastructure and the scalability to run whatever you have just deployed at scale. So you will oftentimes see Terraform and Pulumi be mentioned in the sort of operate, although we're going to talk about this in a second. This is also where a lot of the orchestration layers from cloud providers and other software vendors can come in to help you figure out, okay, great. Now you've got this, let's say, container in your Kubernetes environment. Well, now all this production traffic is flooding into it. How do we scale it? And how do we make sure that it's got all the right bits and bobs that help you do the next phase, which is monitoring, which we're going to get to in a second. That's basically what operate is. It's just to say, okay, great. Now you've made it into prod in some way, shape, or form. What are you going to do now? How are you going to make sure that it stays healthy? Now, operate is oftentimes where SRE bleeds into DevOps, site reliability and engineering, which is a whole other term that we're not going to get into, but usually deals with a lot of the scalability, healthiness, and uptimeness, if you will, of production software.
Very important stuff. However, you know, you shouldn't think massive scale on day one. That is definitely a problem and a problem worth solving, but not one we want to get to prematurely.
Mm-hmm. And there's lots of cool architecture discussions that you can look up in videos that you can find from AWS reInvent and Google Next and all these kinds of things about going from like one user to 10 million users and all the different scalability features that go into that. Often all of those are in this sort of operate phase.
And I'm super excited about what you're going to talk about next, because that will actually be a big piece of this.
All right. And so the final step in this infinity continuum, if you will, is to monitor. And if you think that John's not going to freak out about us talking about monitoring, you're wrong. Now, we're going to hyper oversimplify here again, but monitoring is basically where you actually take all the telemetry from said running application and use that to do all sorts of things. So this is logs, and this is all the different metrics and charting and alerting and visualizations that you're pulling out of this. And oftentimes this is not only infrastructure based, like CPU utilization and memory utilization, disk IO and net IO, but actual application performance as well. So effective monitoring goes all the way back down to the code layer and says, this particular function should take 4 microseconds to run. For some reason, after the last push, it now takes 400 microseconds. So something's gone horribly wrong. This also gets into a lot of the validation of things like big O notation, if you're into software development, about making sure that you're actually operating at the O you think that you're operating at. If you don't know what I mean about big O notation, you are lucky, and I wish you never have to learn it. And it's a big interview piece if you're going to be a software developer someday.
So, instead of just subjectively saying, I like Kyle's code or I like John's code, John can write code to do task A, Kyle can write code to do task A, and then we can do monitoring and we can look at, to be able to do task A with John's code, this many CPU cycles, this much traffic across the network, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we have tangible results as a result, as a end product of that code. And then we have something to compare between the two.
Correct. So performance and comparison are super healthy. Oftentimes in software development shops, you'll have one or two people try to tackle the same problem and see who can do it more efficiently. This is, again, where big O notation comes in, where it's, you know, you can be extremely efficient by changing the type of O notation that you're using, i.e., can you do something at the exact same rate no matter the load, or does an increase in load cause an exponential increase in how much you need to figure out? These are very matrixed problems inside of software development. But yes, that is a great way to make sure that you are actually looking at what matters and helping your business decide what actually matters so that you can make improvements. Oftentimes, monitoring is one of those things that is a continuous learning environment, meaning when you have an outage, you will go find root cause analysis and you go, aha, I need to add this to my monitoring in the future so that I know when this is going to happen again in some way, shape, or form.
Love it.
Yes. All right. Whew. All right. We reached the end of the 8 stages. But we can't really go on until we talk a little bit about more macro level orchestration. So This is a humongous topic that we are not going to dive too deeply on right now, but I want to give everybody kind of an overview. No matter which cloud provider you are on, all of them provide some form of managed everything I just told you as a service, all right? On Google, it's called Cloud Build. On AWS, it's called Code Deploy. On Azure, it's called Azure DevOps or ADO. You'll commonly see that referred to in a lot of different ways. And these are simply ways that they take their particular services and they offer them in a big packaged bundle so that you don't have to deal with any of the underlying infrastructure other than what it takes to actually run the code that you're deploying. So things like, you know, your VMs or your container infrastructure, things like that. But you don't have to like install Jenkins or install a source repository. It just allows you to use all these things in one big package that has a flat rate usually, or is you know, charges you for a variety of different metrics. But it's very simple to go set up. And I mean, very simple. Now, I'm going to date myself here a little bit. I was at the reInvent where AWS Code Deploy was launched, and I was probably one of the first 10 users of that because I remember logging into the console as they were announcing it on stage, and I was testing it with the code that I was running back at CrossFit HQ. Yes, I was testing on prod, everybody. It's a bad thing. Don't do it. But at the time, it was Wild West of AWS.
Exactly.
They're really cool. And the only concern that I would give people is when you're starting out, these things are incredible amplifiers of you getting started quickly. But as you scale, you may find that you reach some of the limits of these things. And so I would never have like Netflix running on any of these sort of orchestrated engines because there's just too much. It's too big. It's at too much scale. They need to be able to tune each layer of all this workflow in order to make things happen. So just realize that there are orchestration layers out there. Now, you could also call Kubernetes to some extent an orchestration layer for all of these things because there are methods that you can use that go through all of this. You can also call like VMware to some extent kind of an orchestration layer because there's a bunch of software that lives on top of that. OpenStack is another one that you could kind of call in this orchestration layer as well for this whole process. It just requires some finagling in some way, shape, or form.
And there are going to be people that are very passionate about all these things.
Oh, yeah. I just upset a lot of nerds in the world by oversimplifying that statement in that way. But just hear us out. You can do a lot with all these things.
You've got the idea now. And the nice thing about these orchestration tools that Kyle talked about, if you want to get started quickly and you don't want to build yet another thing and find yet another server for it to run on, et cetera, this is a way to get going quickly.
All right. So we've got to cover another topic here, which is the use of the word continuous in front of lots of other words.
Yes, I was going to say, Kyle, I am not letting you finish this without saying CI/CD and explaining that for people like, what?
All right. So yeah, CI/CD. Let's go through all of them really quick because it's usually referred to as just continuous integration and continuous deployment, but there's also continuous testing and continuous monitoring that go along with that. So really it should be CI/CD, CTCM. No one says that because it's quite a mouthful, but let's get into that for a second. So continuous integration means you can have a lot of people working on the same code. Now, that's one sentence to describe something that is deeply more complicated, and there are incredible books that are out there that will explain this in massive depth. But basically, CI encourages every person to merge their work frequently back into master so that everyone is constantly getting updated from all the code changes that are going on all the time. When you have what's called a monolithic code base, meaning all of your code is in like one location and does one massive thing, and there's arguments pro and con for all this microservice versus monolith, and lots of companies that are humongous use these monolithic code bases. It's incredibly important that you have a system that is constantly keeping code up to date for everybody that is working on code, because you might have hundreds to thousands of developers working on the same code at the same time, which sounds insane, don't get me wrong, but works because you have a continuous integration platform in some way, shape, or form. Then you have continuous deployment. Continuous deployment just means automatically pushing those changes to places where you can test it. And I wish it was more complicated than that, but that's basically what it is. So
this is one that, you know, I will tell you, I had, when I was going through all the route switch stuff, I had the hardest time figuring out how tunneling worked. I don't know why. That was just the thing that it took. It was so hard for my brain to process.
Meta, and
I
think, packets and packets and packets.
Right. Yeah. But then kind of like once you do it a couple times, you're like, oh, wait a minute, this is super simple. But until I did it, no amount, no hundreds of pages of reading made that symbol. And I was really, really angry, actually, because I read so many hundreds of pages and no one could write this in such a way that I could understand it. And then once I went and did it, I was like, oh, that's it.
Yeah.
Can you tell, like, give me an example of continuous deployment? Like, what's that actually look like?
Yeah, sure. We'll do a simple one, but this is basically it, right? I'm a developer and I just submitted a pull request, right? Which means my code went up to somebody for a review to say, hey, I want to merge this into master. As soon as I submitted that pull request, here's what happens. And again, one example, there are many of this and we can apply this in a bunch of ways. The system ran all of my tests, my unit, my smoke, my regression, all my tests got run and it said, hey, these passed. And it said, okay, great. Deploy it to the test environment. It literally fired up a VM or fired up a container system from scratch. Just for the record here, it's going to get thrown away in about 25 seconds, but it fires it up from scratch and puts all the code that I just wrote in there and then throws live data at it in real time and says, hey, here's the monitoring from that system. Does it look okay to you? That's one example of sort of continuous deployment is I clicked a button to merge some code and it went all the way to prod and started showing me metrics. And
okay, can you open the hood of the car up for me real quick and sure. Tell me what happened there? So you were on your computer and let's say just for giggles, you wrote a Python script on your Mac, you wrote a Python script and then you went to the command line and you said what?
Okay. So if I'm in my command line, which just gonna throw this out here, I'd be in VS Code and I'd be using a toolkit, but whatever.
Okay, like, that's a good. I count that as command line. Great.
All right. Yep. So I've got my code. I've checked it out. It's in my own private branch inside of GitHub or GitLab, whatever you want to be using here. Any of your service control orchestration tools. And I've said, okay, I've written my code. I've run my local tests. I've linted it. I've done all the things that I need to for software development methodology. I'm ready to pull a request, and so it sends a request up to your source code repository, GitHub again, or GitLab.
Yep, there you go. It's GitHub for giggles here.
Okay. So
the code went from your Mac in your software that you chose to write your code in, and it went up to GitHub.
That's right.
Then what happened?
And so now it's a pull request and tests are going to run because I've configured GitHub to run these tests, or I have something like Jenkins or a bunch of other tools that are kind of in place that are running all these things. And so
Jenkins noticed you made a change to a repo that it was monitoring. It's like, oh, hey, I know when changes are made, I need to do X, Y, Z, etc.
That's right. And so it starts running all the tests that my developers have configured for all the different elements of the code that this thing touches.
Take that code, put it on a server, a container, or whatever. Take that and run it somewhere, present it in some way.
That's right. And oftentimes the result of this is to say, hey, we ran all the tests against this and it passed. And here's a link directly for you to interact with that environment in some way, shape, or form, i.e., it's an API endpoint that I can hit and I can throw some dummy data at it myself if I want to, or it's a website that I can click a button and go to and browse, or there's 100 ways you can kind of skin this cat, but now it is deployed there. Now, when you go to the more mature ends of continuous deployment, what also can happen is it will go into a stage environment, or it will go into a test environment. Tests will be run against it and it will go, cool, it passed those tests. It will automatically start deploying it into the stage environment and it will throw copies of live data that have been exfilled from your production environment into the dev environment or into the staging environment. Sorry, there's too many environments going on. And it will start testing against live data in like a delayed stream. And it will look at those for health checks across a variety of strata. And if it says, hey, this ran for the last 5 minutes completely fine and error-free, it'll automatically roll it into production and put it on a canary server, let's just say. So like a canary server in this case, you can imagine the Google website runs on like thousands to millions of containers out there in the world. What can happen is this can be a release candidate for production that goes to, let's say, just 10 servers that are in the pool receiving live data in any given moment. And it will monitor all the performance metrics from those 10 containers or those 10 VMs or whatever against the thousands of the rest of them that are running, and it'll look for anomalies. And if after a certain amount of time, let's say 10 minutes, there's no anomalies detected, it says, great, I'm going to roll that to not 10, but 100. So now 100 out of the 1,000 are now running your canary code, and it monitors all 100 of those against anomalies for the rest of the system. And maybe after a day, that's now rolled out to all the servers. So I want everyone to remember, when you go to gmail.com, when you check your mail, the odds that you see the exact same version of code serving to you as the person sitting next to you in the office or the house next door are exceedingly close to zero, because everybody that runs these like web-based tools is constantly being tested with new code and you don't know it, right? If you've ever loaded up Gmail and there was like a quick error and you were like, huh, and you hit the refresh button and it worked and you just were like, oh, guess it was me. It probably wasn't you. It was probably some crazy code that was being committed and being tested on you live in production, because that's a great way to sort of monitor these changes. And when you think about the amount of efficiencies that a company like Google and a product like Gmail are trying to get out of it, they're testing all the time. And they may say, oh, that got a 0.5% more fast in some way, shape, or form. And they go, great, that's success. Wonderful. But maybe it got 2% slower some days. Well, they just roll that back and they don't push that out to production. So it gets thick when you get into the CD of the CI/CD.
And to bring it back real quick, why do I care about this in the military? Let me just tell you, if you didn't have this, let's just talk about the number of enterprise tickets you would need to have approved to make each of these things happen. And even though I like stopped Kyle and made him go kind of like more nitty gritty, I want to point out we glossed over and skipped several steps, even when we went down and burrowed deep. That would be an awful lot of enterprise tickets, an awful lot. If you are doing this manually, souls are crying in pain.
I want to call this out too. An effective CI/CD process means a couple things. One, it means you can change things very quickly and have the impact of those changes felt everywhere, right? In true DevOps fashion, you'd be like, DevOps problem is now everywhere. But also solution can now be everywhere in so many ways and shapes and forms. This is a net positive thing. Speed is equal to lots of positive outcomes when it comes to anything. Response to security actions or response to cyber threats in some way, shape, or form. Remediation of known vulnerabilities when they get released. And also it's way cheaper to do things faster like this when you don't have tons and tons of engineers running cycles back and forth waiting for their opportunity to deploy. And you can just be like, no, go deploy the code. And if it changes and things break, we'll all know it. We'll just roll it back. It's super fine. You get a lot of freedom and speed out of that, which usually in a business concept leads to money, and in a military concept leads to response, fast response, which is where it's at, everybody.
And I would say offering Marines opportunities. The faster you are, the more your Marines are going to be able to do. They are 100% going to be limited by the system that you put in front of them.
Yep.
So give them the ability to move quickly, which I would argue this is probably the only way to do that, certainly in our types of environments. Give them the ability to move quickly, and then it's just on the Marines and their ingenuity and how much access they have to the customers and how much risk you're willing to take. But that's where things get truly exciting.
Right. And for those of you who have studied things like combat, you might understand that speed is valuable in some ways at times. Hey, John, we may have been taught a few things on that.
Yes.
Yep. Okay, so let's jump to these last two. So we got continuous testing and continuous monitoring. This is much easier to explain because it's pretty much what it sounds like. But continuous testing just means, hey, I tested it when I deployed the code. I'm done, right? Wrong. You have no idea what could break in 1,000 different ways or ways that malicious users can be throwing new data at your system. So you want to be continuously testing all the time. And when you test, you want those results to be sent to a monitoring system of some way, shape, or form so that you can then be reported upon on that. So, you know, continuous integration, continuous deployment, i.e. CI/CD, go hand in hand. And then continuous testing, continuous monitoring, i.e. CTCM, pretty much go hand in hand as well. And you put all those together, and now you've got a really good method of deploying your stuff out there, knowing when it's broken, knowing how to fix it, and being able to do that quite quickly. What do you think, John?
I'm loving this.
Okay.
Is there anything else that we should discuss here?
Yeah, I want to go through a few different things. You will commonly see this broken down into five categories when people are explaining pipelines as well, or especially when you look at cloud providers. Oftentimes there's, where's your source code? How are you building and testing combined into one phase? Because most of the tools that do build also do test. Where are you storing your artifacts that you are creating out of that build and test? How are you deploying them? And then how are you monitoring them? Those are the five buckets that generally get used here. So when you think of where's your source code, this is your GitHub, your GitLab, your Bitbuckets, when that used to be a thing, et cetera. Then you think about building and testing. This is where things like Jenkins, Travis CI, Circle CI, TeamCity, and Concourse way back in the day, like there's a lot of different things that kind of go into this. And almost every cloud provider has their own version of this also, like a just build and test, okay? Then you get into artifact storage. There's a bunch of different options here. There are services that you can do like Artifactory and JFrog and all these kind of things that are out there that you can use. But also you could just store this in like an S3 bucket or any sort of object store that's out there. It's just a file at the end of the day. But oftentimes having these things in an artifact registry means that you can version control those files. So you can like pin versions of the software that you've created in some way, shape or form. And lots of these things kind of go out there. If you're used to the Linux world, the packages and distributions that you download come from an artifact repository, et cetera. Okay. Then you get into deploy, and this is where magic kind of happens. So technically Jenkins can do this as well, but this is commonly what you will see with like Chef, Puppet, Ansible, Salt, Bash scripts, as well as fully orchestrated things like Spinnaker, which is one of my favorites if you're using a container environment, which has been sort of superseded by a lot of stuff. But like Spinnaker was the jam in the day, which is like everything you need to put things where it needs to go inside of the namespace that you want it to be inside of Kubernetes. It's super hot. And then monitor, right? Like, how are you reading your telemetry? So this is everything from like Grafana and Prometheus to third-party stuff like Datadog and you know, all New Relic, all these different things that are out there that are products that you can use to kind of monitor this stuff. And every cloud provider also has this sort of thing. There used to be like Stackdriver, which is now called Cloud Operations, I think, on GCP. And all these bits and bobs that kind of go in, and there's versions of that on every cloud provider that's out there as well. And that's generally what it would be considered a modern CI/CD pipeline, is a combination of all these tools. So I think that brings us to the end of CI/CD and DevOps in particular on this overview. But we got a couple of things we want to tap on, I think, John.
Yes, I think we do.
Okay, so we're going to talk about Dora the Explorer, right? Am I missing that? Or
it's so Dora, close. But not so of the Explorer fame.
All right, for those of you who haven't heard of Dora, it's a very cool organization called the DevOps Research and Assessment Group. They used to be privately funded, and then Google Cloud sort of bought them and invests in them heavily. And they every year come out with this report that's called the State of DevOps Report, which, if you've never read one of these before, it's very, very cool. They interview hundreds of thousands of people and companies that are out there and ask them for their assessment of their own maturity across a huge spectrum of different rating systems. I think there are 34 pillars inside of the Dora report that assess different companies based on everything you can think of, from how often they're deploying to the types of tooling that they're using. And just it's a deep well of super cool information. But Dora is actually a really good way for you to assess your own company and your own business. And if you're really trying to take, I'm going to be stereotypical here for just a second. If you're trying to take like a military organization that's not familiar with DevOps in any way, and you're trying to start to organize the discussions around what it might mean to be more DevOps focused or more modern in your CI/CD pipeline and your framework, the Dora reports are great ways to sort of structure those conversations. They also have a bunch of documentation and white papers around the ROI that can come from DevOps, because, and I can't stress this enough, everybody that I ever talk to just wants to add DevOps to cart and prime overnight it. I'm sure anyone who's listened to the cast for long enough has heard me say that metaphor like 10 times, but it's true. And so it can be maddeningly difficult to go talk to a CFO or someone in the finance organization or someone in your business investment arm and say, we should adopt DevOps. And they say, why? And you say, because it's going to make us better and faster. And they're like, how does that change how much money I make? Now, the military obviously doesn't have that struggle, but there are tons of value that still come out of it that are non-financial that you can do. And there's a really good white paper where some of you might know one of the authors. Mr. Gene Kim, friend of the show, was a contributing author on this white paper. We're going to put a link to that thing in the show notes. But it's really good. And it goes through some of those value-driven categories of why DevOps is important and the cost-driven categories of why DevOps is important. It goes through different ways that you can calculate those values. It shows you some basic formulas that you can use to talk to people who love financial formulas. And it also talks about how you can actually build a true ROI statement out of this and how you can look at how long that's going to take to actually pay back and what different parts of your organization might want to see out of this. It's a pretty good read. The white paper, I think it's 35, 36 pages. Oh, 40. I was wrong. But the last ones are kind of just...
Your bluff here, or TLDR, is you should not have to stand at a whiteboard and figure this stuff out.
That is absolutely right.
Like, thankfully, someone has put the thought into this for you. Go out and read those papers. The work has been done. Take what they've done, insert your use cases, you know, step three profit.
That's right. Please do us a favor. Just like we've said, don't build your own password management software or don't build your own password requirements documentation or anything like that in the past, do not try to invent a new way to justify DevOps. I promise there are bodies laying along that path for miles and miles, and we've got a good system of it. This ROI white paper is one of many resources that you can use out there, but starting with the DORA program and that group is a really great place to start when you need to have business and technological conversations around why DevOps matters and why you should invest in it. All right. We covered a lot here, and this is we're probably going to be over an hour on this cast, which is a rarity for us, but I love it when we get a chance to do this. And again, to all of our listeners, we really oversimplified a lot of this stuff. It's a very deep category. Highly recommend anybody that wants to learn more about this stuff. Start with DORA. You can read anything Gene Kim's ever written. Google has an entire series of books on site reliability engineering, which is a great way to sort of get the practitioner's guide to how to implement a lot of these things in practice. But I want to double click on what John said, and this is going to be my hot take right now in advance of everything we just covered, okay? And that is this. Go do this. There are so many labs and Medium articles and company written articles about how to go build a CI/CD pipeline. How to go implement this across the way. If you want to just like go to AWS or Google or Azure and like use one of those tools we talked about, use Cloud Build or use Code Deploy or use Azure DevOps and just like launch a website on a real basic small VM or in a container, go do it, because you gotta get your hands dirty on this stuff to understand why this is important, right? You gotta run into a problem deploying some code to find out why this is important. I'll give a very specific example about this. I tried to write a chatbot a couple days ago for Slack for the place that I am employed, because I wanted to write a virtual, you're on mute, you have to put a dollar in the jar bot. Okay? Silly as heck.
This is writing code to solve real problems.
Real problems that are changing the world, ladies and gentlemen. All right? But this is the thing. I basically built a quick CI/CD pipeline using one of those products that I just mentioned. You can probably guess which one if you know me and where I work. And it was great, because I straight up used like Google Bard, the AI toolkit, to help me like figure out how to build the API calls. I was using GitHub's Copilot to help me write the code for this thing. And I did the whole thing in about an hour, like research to deployed. And like tested in my dev environment. I did not deploy this to my company's production Slack environment. But like I figured out how to make this work in about an hour, because I wanted to touch some code again. I haven't done that in a while. But it's great, because when I messed it up, I just went back to the source repository and I just edited the code inside of VS Code and like clicked the pull request and went back and merged my own pull request, because I'm a team of one right now. And it just works, and I can watch the water flow through all those pipes, and it just sends me a little message and says, hey, ran your tests. Tests were good. We deployed it. It's ready to rock. Want to go ahead and test? And I can throw the commands at it, and it goes, hey, it worked. So
yeah, and shout out to A-Cloud Guru. Again, not cast endorsement, but John endorsement. Get them on a free trial to see if you like it. They have an entire course that will take you through all of this stuff. And if you don't have hands on keyboard, they'll show you videos of what it looks like as it goes through all that stuff. Maybe that's enough for you. If not, they've got a sandbox environment where they'll have this all basically stood up for you. They'll have the code written already. All you have to do is kind of like do the mechanical movements to move things around, and you can watch all that stuff happen. You can tweak it if you want to. You can kind of go off the script. But there are so many different ways. Or you can buy yourself a Raspberry Pi and do it like that. There's a million ways you can make these things happen. You know how you're going to learn best. But you know, at this point, 2023, there are no excuses. There is a way here.
That's right. And the last thing that I'll add onto that is DevOps is the death knell of choice paralysis when it comes to tools. There are 1,000 build test softwares out there. All right. Doesn't matter which one you pick, just pick one. You know, if I got to tell you right now, I would say use GitHub, use Jenkins or Travis, store your stuff in whatever artifact repository you want. But right now, just drop it into a bucket anywhere, an object store bucket. And then, I don't know, use Spinnaker for deployment, or go just use the built-in stuff with Jenkins that'll do that stuff for you too. And then monitor with something open source. So use Grafana or Cactus or Prometheus. All those things are perfectly fine that you can use. They cost you very little monies, because it's just the storage in there. And just like give it a go. See how it works. Monitor your logs, as always, everybody.
Okay, Kyle, we covered a bunch. Is there anything else that we need to hit before we sign off here?
Reading is fundamental, and go check those trainings. There's no excuse for this. The free tier of any of the cloud providers will allow you to do this, like build a CI/CD pipeline about 10,000 times before you run out of money. So let us know. And if you got any good, anyone out there listening to the cast finds a good demo that they think is a really canonical way to kind of do this, drop it to us on Twitter.
Dear listeners, thank you for joining us. You can connect with us on social media by going to Twitter and following at USMC underscore TFPHOENIX. That's at USMC underscore Task Force Phoenix. Our editor is Sarah Clarkson, and marketing support is provided by Jake Osborne. You can support the cast by going to Apple Podcasts and giving us a 5-star review with accompanying comment. And with that, we are out.